Chapter 15. The Haynes brothers' machinery was on the same ship. Jock and Duff rowed down to Port Natal together, hired 100 wagons, and brought it all back in one load. "I'll tell you what I'll do with you, Jock. I'll wager you that we get our mills producing before you do. Loser pays for the transport of the whole shipment." Duff challenged him when they reached Johannesburg, where, in Candy's new barroom, they were washing the dust out of their throats. "You're on. I'll go further. I'll put up a side bet of 500. Sean prodded Duff in the ribs. "Gently, Duff, we can't afford it." But Jock had already snapped up the bet.
"What do you mean we can't afford it?" whispered Duff.
"We've got nearly £1,500 left on the letter of credit." Sean shook his head.
"No, we haven't."
Duff pulled the paper from his inside pocket and tapped Sean's nose with it. "There, read for yourself." Sean took it out of Duff's hand.
"Thanks, old chap. I'll go and pay the man now."
"What man?"
"The man with the wagons."
"What wagons?"
The wagons that you and Jock hired in Port Natal. I've bought them."
"The hell you say.
It was your idea to start a transport business. Just as soon as they've offloaded, they'll be on their way again to pick up a shipment of coal from Dundee."
Duff grinned at him.
"Don't you ever forget an idea?"
"All right, laddie, off you go. We'll just have to win the bet, that's all."
One of the mills they placed on the Candy Deep, the other on the new claims beyond the Cousin Jock mine. They hired two gangs from among the unemployed in Johannesburg. Curtis supervised one of them and Sean the other, while Duff darted back and forth, keeping an eye on both. Each time they passed the Cousin Jock, he spent a few minutes checking Trevor and Jock's progress.
"They've got the edge on us, Sean. Their boilers are up and holding pressure already," he reported fretfully. But the next day he was smiling again.
"They didn't mix enough cement in the platform. It started to crumble as soon as they put the crusher on it. They'll have to cast it again. That set them back 3 or 4 days.
The betting down in the canteens fluctuated sharply with each change of fortune. Francois came up to the Candy Deep one Saturday afternoon. He watched them work, made a suggestion or two, then remarked,
"They're giving 3-1 against you at the Bright Angels. They reckon the Haynesies will be finished by next weekend."
"Go down and put another £500 on for me," Duff told him, and Sean shook his head despairingly.
"Don't worry, laddie, we can't lose. That amateur mining engineer Jock Haynes has assembled his crusher jaws all arse about face. I only noticed it this morning. He's in for a surprise when he tries to start up. He'll have to strip the whole damn rig."
Duff was right. They brought both their mills into production a comfortable 15 hours before the Haynes brothers. Jock rode over to see them with his jaw on his chest.
"Congratulations."
"Thanks, Jock. Did you bring your checkbook?"
"That's what I came to talk about. Can you give me a little time?"
"Your credit's good," Sean assured him. "Come and have a drink, and let me sell you some coal."
"Ah, yes. I heard your wagons arrived back this morning. What prices are you charging?"
£15 a hundredweight."
"Good God, you bloody bandit. I bet it cost you less than 5 shillings a hundredweight."
"A man's entitled to a reasonable profit," protested Sean.
It had been a long, hard pull up to the top of the hill, but Sean and Duff had arrived at last, and from there it was downhill all the way. The money poured in. The geological freak that had bowed the Leader Reef away from the main across the Candy Deep claims had at the same time enriched it, injected it full of metal. Francois was there one evening when they put the ball of amalgam into the retort. His eyes bulged as the mercury boiled away. He stared at the gold the way a man watches a naked woman.
"God,
I'm going to have to call you Two Thunders, mister, from now on.
Have you ever seen richer reef, Francois? Duff gloated.
Francois shook his head slowly. You know my theory about the reef being the bed of an old lake? Well, this bears it out. The kink in your reef must have been a deep trench along the bottom of the lake. It would have acted as a natural gold trap.
Hell, man, what luck! With your eyes closed, you have picked the plum out of the pudding. The Jock and Whistle is half as rich as this.
Their overdraft at the bank dropped like a barometer in a hurricane. The tradesman started greeting them with a smile. They gave Doc Sutherland a cheque which would have kept even him in whiskey for 100 years. Candy kissed them both when they paid her out in full, plus interest at 7%. Then she built herself a new hotel, double-storied, with a crystal chandelier in the dining room and a magnificent bedroom suite on the second floor, done out in maroon and gold. Duff and Sean rented it immediately, but with the express understanding that if ever the Queen visited Johannesburg, they would allow her to use it. In anticipation, Candy called it the Victoria Rooms. Francois, with a little persuasion, agreed to take over the running of the Candy Deep. He moved his possessions, one chest of clothes and four chests of patent medicines, across from the Jock and Whistle. Martin Curtis was the manager of the mill on the new claims. They named it the Little Sister Mine. Although not nearly as rich as the Candy Deep, it was producing a sweet fortune each month, for Curtis worked it as well as he fought. By the end of August, Sean and Duff had no more creditors. The claims were theirs, the mills were theirs, and they had money to invest.
"We need an office of our own here in town. We can't run this show from our bedrooms," complained Sean.
"You're right," agreed Duff. "We'll build on that corner plot, nearest the market square." The plan was for a modest little four-room building, but it finally expanded to 2 stories, stinkwood floors, oak panelling, and 20 rooms. What they couldn't use, they rented.
"The price of land has trebled in 3 months," said Sean, "and it's still moving."
"You're right. Now's the time to buy," Duff agreed.
"You're starting to think along the right lines."
"It was your idea."
"Was it?" Duff looked surprised.
"Don't you remember your 'up where the eagles fly' speech?"
"Don't you forget anything?" asked Duff.
They bought land, 1,000 acres at Orange Grove, and another 1,000 around Hospital Hill. Their transport wagons, now almost 400 strong, plied in daily from Port Natal and Lorenzo Marks. Their brickfields worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to try to meet the demand for building materials. It took Sean almost a week to dissuade Duff from building an opera house, but he succeeded, and instead they joined most of the other members of the Diggers Committee in financing a different type of pleasure palace. At Duff's suggestion, they called it the Opera House. They recruited the performers not from the great companies of Europe, but from the dock areas of Cape Town and Port Natal, and chose as the conductor a Frenchwoman of vast experience named Blue Bessie, after the colour of her hair. The Opera House provided entertainment on 2 levels. For the members of the committee and other emergent rich, there was a discreet side entrance, a lavishly furnished lounge where one could buy the finest champagne and discuss the prices on the Kimberley Stock Exchange, and beyond the lounge were a series of tastefully decorated retiring rooms. For the workers, there was a bare corridor to queue in, no choice for your money, and a 5-minute time limit. In 1 month, the Opera House produced more gold than the Jack and Whistle Mine. By December, there were millionaires in Johannesburg. Hadratsky, the Haynes brothers, Carl Lochtkamper, Duff Charleywood, Sean Courtney, and 12 others. They owned the mines, the land, the buildings, and the city. The aristocracy of the Witwatersrand, knighted with money and crowned with gold. A week before Christmas, Hradsky, their unacknowledged but undoubted king, called them all to a meeting in one of the private lounges of Candy's hotel. "Who the hell does he think he is?" complained Jock Haines, "orging us around like a bunch of Kaffirs." "Verdammit, Juden," agreed Locht Camper. But they went, every last one of them, for whatever Hradsky did had the smell of money about it, and they could not resist it any more than a dog can resist the smell of a bitch in season. Duff and Sean were the last to arrive, and the room was already hazed with cigar smoke and tense with expectation. Hradsky sagged into one of the polished leather armchairs, with Max sitting quietly beside him. His eyes flickered when Duff walked in, but his expression never changed. When Duff and Sean had found chairs, Max stood up. "Gentlemen, Mr. Hradsky has invited you here to consider a proposition." They leaned forward slightly in their chairs, and there was a glitter in their eyes, like hounds close upon the fox. "From time to time, it is necessary for men in your position to find capital to finance further ventures and to consolidate past gains. On the other hand, those of us who have money lying idle will be seeking avenues for investment." Max cleared his throat and looked at them with his sad brown eyes. "Up to the present, there has been no meeting place for these mutual needs, such as exists in the other centres of the financial world. Our nearest approach to it is the Stock Exchange at Kimberley, which, I'm sure you will agree, is too far removed to be of practical use to us here at Johannesburg. Mr. Hradsky has invited you here to consider the possibility of forming our own exchange, and, if you accept the idea, to elect a chairman and governing body." Max sat down, and in the silence that followed, they took up the idea, each one fitting it into his scheme of thinking, testing it with the question, "How will I benefit?"
"Yeah, it's a damn fine idea," Loch Camper spoke first.
"Yes, it's what we need.
Count me in."
Then they schemed and bargained, setting the fees, the place, and the rules. Sean watched their faces, the faces of bitter men, happy men, quiet ones, and big bull roarers, but all with one common feature, that greedy glitter in the eyes. It was midnight before they finished. Max stood up again. "Gentlemen, Mr. Hradsky would like you to join him in a glass of champagne to celebrate the formation of our new enterprise."
"This I can't believe. The last time he paid for drinks was back in 60, declared Duff. "Quickly, somebody, find a waiter before he changes his mind."
Hradsky hooded his eyes to hide the hatred in them.